Welcome, everyone. We have a terrific episode. Irene, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
We have a terrific episode today. Tell everybody what we're going to do today.
I'm very excited. Today, we have Doug Thiemann here on the podcast. He is going to tell us a little bit about what life is like for him and how he has recovered from a couple different things.
Absolutely. And Doug is a legend in the field of recovery.
That's right.
And you're going to find out exactly who Crosstalk Podcast attracts, because Doug is probably the most significant person that the Caron Treatment Center has seen through its doors since Richard Caron started it about 70 years ago. Doug, welcome to Crosstalk Podcast.
Corey, Irene, thanks so much for having me. Delighted to be here. My first time back in New York City since I retired as president and CEO of Caron in 2021. So it's nice to be back in New York City.
Oh, well, that's great.
We're honored to have you back. And thank you for taking the trip from Pennsylvania to be in New York City to be with us and to share your story with our guests, with our audience. Very, very happy that you're here. Doug, tell us a little bit about how life started for Doug Thiemann.
How life started for Doug Thiemann. I would just say, like most people at Caron knew, that I grew up on a pig farm, rural Missouri, one room, grade school, all of that type of thing. Great childhood. But I was, I got the gene, I guess you would say, to help people. I hated seeing people in misery. And so that really became my career path. I initially thought I wanted to be a pastor, ended up working for the church as a teacher, later as a fundraiser. And it was that fundraising component that eventually led me in 1983 to work for Hazelden as one of their first fundraisers to start the Hanley Hazelden Center. So I always said, you can have plans, God laughs. And I oftentimes even do a talk that said, God has other plans. And frankly, his plans are always better, even if we don't understand it at the time. And you'll hear that through my story.
Where'd you get that gene from?
You know, growing up in rural Missouri, we were a very church-oriented family. And there were five boys growing up on a farm. We knew we couldn't slice and dice our farm five ways. So really the options at that time were, one, you did what your dad did. And even though I was the oldest, I probably had first shot at it. I didn't want to do it. The second was you went into the military. The Vietnam War was going on at the time. That didn't seem all that attractive. And the third was church work. And so that's what I gravitated to. The idea of being a lawyer or a CPA or a doctor, I mean, that was just so totally foreign to where I grew up. So it was very early on, I was just struck by, I think I want to go into church work. I want to help people. I hate seeing people suffer.
I love that. And so when you were younger, going into the church, what did you first start doing in terms of fundraising? How did you do that? How did you start in that,
Well, again, an accidental thing. I really didn't know anything about it or understand anything about it. But our parents taught us the concept of tithing very early on. And I never will forget a story once of, we had this sort of coin jar that we did stuff through the week, and you put it in the coin jar. And then on Sunday, as we went to church, we would take some coins out of there. And I never will forget once my dad said, why don't you take a quarter and a nickel today? And one of those you should give to the church. The other one you get to keep yourself. And I thought, man, that's really cool. So anyways, on the way back home from church, my dad said, so Doug, which one did you decide to keep? And I said, I decided to keep the quarter. And I gave God the nickel, and I got this frowned look on his face, and I knew immediately it must have been the wrong answer. And he said, why did you do that? And I quickly responded, I learned in Sunday school that God loves a cheerful giver, and I'm a whole lot more cheerful with a quarter than I am with a nickel. So we learned about tithing. The part about becoming a professional fundraiser really didn't happen until I was in college. And it was just, again, I knew nothing about it. I have no idea why they hired me, but again, God has plans for us that sometimes we don't understand how we land there. And I was blessed that happened for me.
did you enjoy the first job, and what position was it?
So my first job, actually, I taught at a Lutheran high school in Baltimore, Maryland. I absolutely loved it. I taught social studies, you know, history, geography, government, baseball coach, kind of the classic social studies coach deal. And I loved it. I really, really did. And I was in a relationship then, and the woman that I was with said, you know, you're never going to make much money as a teacher. And it really didn't bother me. I grew up poor. You know, all the other teachers were in the same financial situation, and it never occurred to me the idea of being poor. And she really pushed me to say, you know, you're too smart to be this poor. You need to do something else. And that ultimately led to our split, which at the time I thought was crushing to me. But again, one of those things where God had a better plan. At the time, I thought this was one of the worst things that happened. I wanted to get the heck out of Baltimore. I wanted to be away from all of that. And a friend of mine who I taught with was now working for a Lutheran college in Michigan and said, hey, do you want to come here and be a fundraiser? And I had no idea what it meant. And I said, hey, it's not Baltimore. I get to work with you. You're a good friend. Let's do it. So that's how I got into fundraising. I met my wife there, learned a new profession. And again, God had a better plan for me.
How'd you meet your wife?
She was in the admissions department. And one of the things that we did at fundraising is we would go to different communities around the country, and we would always want a student who had graduated to kind of get up and kind of do the testimonial about what a great college it was. And so to find that student, we would call the admissions rep from that community. She was based in Minneapolis, St. Paul. So I called her up, and she thought it was funny. She looked at, you know, the yearbook, you know, she thought I was going to be a 50-year-old, you know, whatever, and showed up, and we, you know, hit it off and started dating, and ended up getting married. And it's, again, best thing that ever happened to me.
And how old were you when you got married?
Let's see, that would have been 1983. So I guess I was 28. And we've been married now we just celebrated our 42nd wedding anniversary in June.
And it's going well.
Time of our life. Because of recovery. And I'm sure we'll get to that. Because of recovery.
Yes,
it was good before recovery, but it was been great after recovery.
So tell me a little bit about what that looked like for you. It sounds like you're doing great. You're in Michigan. You're successful. You just found the woman of your dreams and you're married. Everything seems to be the perfect picture. So what happened? When did it unravel, I guess?
Well, it got better before it got worse. Again, talk about the sort of strange things that lead us to where we're going. I'm in Green Bay, Wisconsin, catching my flight back to the Upper Peninsula, and I bump into somebody that I knew who had been at the college beforehand. He had subsequently, he was working at a place called Hazelden. And he said, you know, how do you like living in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan? I said, actually, I don't. I'm getting married, and I don't think my wife is going to love Upper Peninsula of Michigan at all. So does that answer your question? He goes, great. He said, well, Hazelden is going to be starting a facility in West Palm Beach, Florida, that they're going to call Hanley Hazelden. And they want somebody to go down there and just kind of do a fundraising feasibility. Could we hire you to do that? And I said, certainly. So I did that. And for whatever reason, Hazelden liked the study so much, they asked that they wanted to hire me to do it. And so I never will forget 2 days after we got married, we actually honeymooned at Disney World. So some people said we had a Mickey Mouse honeymoon. And I said, you know, to Fran, I said, so what do you think of living long-term in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan? He goes, I don't like it. I said, what would you think if we had an opportunity to live in Palm Beach County, Florida? That I think I would like. And I said, well, I've just been offered a job. I actually got offered the job the day before I got married, and I had enough common sense to not spring that on her there. So we made the decision. So in 1983, I went to work for Hazelden and Jack Hanley to start what has now known as the Hanley Hazelden Center. So everything was really going well. I was there for 4 years. We got the Hanley Hazelden Center started. Hazelden then hired me to come to Minnesota to be the head of their fundraising overall. I think I was their youngest vice president in their history. I was a vice president by the age of 30. You know, things were really going well. But as I traveled, that's when my problems began. Always had been a casual social drinker. And one of the things that I realized when I went to Hazel and went through kind of their training programs was, I really knew nothing about alcoholism. I jokingly would say that I know so little about alcoholism, I can't spell AA. In 1983, I wouldn't have known if I had any relative who was an alcoholic. I didn't know an alcoholic. I didn't know anybody who, you know, I thought would have, you know, hit that criteria. Alcoholics had a very different type of stigma in the early 1980s. You know, there were people who, you know, partied hard, that was okay. But the alcoholic was kind of the ne'er-do-well, and maybe some families would have that uncle that you never really talked about. But, you know, that was my understanding. I knew nothing about it. I go through their classes and orientation and learn about it, and I go like, holy Hannah, these people don't drink anything. So for me, I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't have a problem with alcohol. I am not going to be drinking anywhere locally because I don't want anybody to think that. Because at the time, also, you have to understand, almost everybody who worked in the field was in recovery. And I wasn't in recovery. I didn't want to pretend to be in recovery. I just said, you know what, I'm just not going to drink in, you know, Florida where I work. Or once I moved to Minnesota, I'm not going to drink in Minnesota. So I drank when I traveled. And for me, drinking lowered my moral compass, which led me, you know, to other issues. Being a very religious person, as I kind of laid that platform earlier, from the beginning, every time I would do this, the next day, the guilt and remorse would be overwhelming. I was disgusted with myself. I hated what I did. I said, I need to make it up. And so as it led to work, I worked harder. As it led to being a good husband, I would do more things. I was the fix it up, or I would do anything my wife wanted me to do, I did it. Once we started having kids, I wanted to, you know, coach and be the representative and go on field trips. So to the outside, I had it going on. Career was great, moving upward at Hazelden. Looked like, you know, we had a nice house. I did all the things around the yard and stuff, good father. But unfortunately, the disease of alcoholism, and for me, a couple of accompanying issues. One was sex and love addiction. When my compass got lowered, I began to step out of my marriage, violate my marriage vows, which really bothered me. And both of those led then to workaholism and a level of perfectionism around the home. This got so... For me, being a values-driven, moral person, religious person, I mean, like every Sunday I go to church and say, please, God, help me figure this out. You know, where does somebody at Hazelden? And frankly, one of the reasons I took the job at Karen in 1995, I wanted to be a president. I had presidentitis too, I should say that. I had a goal to be president by 40, which I just barely made by about 2 weeks. But I thought, Karen is much smaller than Hazelden. I'm not going to have to travel. Travel is the problem because I only do this when I travel. I don't do it at home. I don't do it in Minnesota. It's only when I travel. So if I stop traveling, I won't have an issue. And there was some truth to that. When I didn't travel, everything was fine. But, Karen grew dramatically during my time there. And so traveling to New York and Florida and DC and Boston and everywhere else became part of it. And so that progressive illness of alcoholism progressed, that progressive illness of sex and love addiction progressed, workaholism and perfectionism progressed. And so that's why every single Sunday at church, I would pray, you know, how do I figure this out? Where does a guy who's, you know, now the president of a treatment center, where do I go for treatment? How do I let people know that I have a drinking problem? And that's really the only thing I wanted to talk about, because the stigma associated with sex and love addiction, was quite profound in the 90s and early 2000s. And frankly, it still is today, which is one of the reasons why I'm willing to talk about it, because there's a lot of people suffering out there from sex and love addiction who don't want to get help and won't get help.
We're grateful that you're speaking about this because we really want to be that space for people where, you know, number one, you feel comfortable to talk about it, but number two, you know, our audience can relate and people can tune in and say, oh my God, I can relate to that. I've never heard anyone say my story or talk about the feeling I have. And, you know, one of my questions is, for me, I started to live my life around my addiction. I would choose a job that fit the addiction rather than what was right or best for me. And I put that in quotes because God plans things and in the end it works out. But would you say that looking back, you can tell that you started to live your life around these trips or around, did you, you know, plan, say, oh, let's move and go bigger in DC or let's make that office in New York? Do you see any correlation to those building that those stepping stones?
That's quite a profound and insightful question. And the answer is probably. I would like to think no, but the reality is probably yes. Mm-hmm. I wanted to grow Karen regardless, but did it make it more exciting for my disease to be traveling as much as I did? And when I started recovery, it was one of the questions my wife asked about, did I have to travel as much? And it really was, just like your question, quite profound and insightful. And I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I will say this, that towards the end, the adrenaline rush of planning a trip was always there. It's like, you know, in fact, one of the things that I didn't really realize till family programming with my kids, because I thought I was being this great father, you know, coaching and vacations. And I realized then that, you know, my wife thought I had an anger issue. She couldn't understand why I was getting so angry. And it made me realize when I was in treatment, I'm on a dry drunk. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been 2 weeks because I did not drink at home. And so if I'd been 2 weeks, I begin to plan, okay, I got to go to New York for a reason, or I got to go to DC I got to go somewhere. And again, I was president. I could, you know, any kind of reason, you know, okay, that makes sense. Board meeting, meet with donors, whatever. I could come up with whatever reason, and it was legitimate. And I always did the work. There was never an issue about that. But that was something that I think really, unfortunately, was, in hindsight, was quite apparent to me about the dry drunks when I wasn't traveling, and then the adrenaline rush when I was, you know, traveling and planning my drinking, hooking up, whatever it was going to be.
So it allowed you to satisfy the need that you need to kind of go outside the marriage and also drink and do things that you wouldn't have otherwise done. So it gave you a reason to do things that actually went to Karen's benefit and to your detriment, but it was something that you needed to do.
Yeah, I kind of said my illness, and again, we do all kind of, I would talk about it, you know, we do all kind of mental manipulation so that we don't go crazy. So I rationalized all this in my mind and said, you know, because of this illness, Karen's getting a really good deal. I mean, they get a guy who's working 60 to 80 hours a week. My wife and kids are getting a really good deal because when I was home, I was very involved, super involved, and to the extent of like neighbors would say, you know, geez, you know, why can't, you know, my husband be more like you? And I'm saying to myself, trust me, you don't want your husband like me. You know, I'm doing this for, unfortunately, all the wrong reasons. And I was getting close to exploding. As I said, you know, I prayed every Sunday, God, help me figure this out. And I refer to, you know, March 4th, 2008 as my divine intervention. When God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I got a DUI that was very public and in the papers, and you know, I kind of, you know, early on say, you know, okay, God, thank you for this divine intervention. It, And I really consider myself quite blessed. I did not hurt myself and I didn't hurt anyone else. As I was going through the mandatory DUI classes, I mean, there were people who are not alcoholic who killed somebody. And I'm going to have to do jail time. And I said, God, thank you for sparing me this. I will dedicate my life to doing the right thing because you've spared me that. You could have maybe made the divine intervention a little less public, but you know what? I probably needed that. Yeah. And God does for us what we can't do for ourselves.
If I remember correctly, that was in Florida while you were the chief cook and bottle washer at Caron.
Yes, I was CEO. I was CEO of Caron. I had been CEO for 13 years. I kind of, interesting. I did 13 years leading up to my addiction or leading up to my recovery. And then I did 13 years afterwards. So I, kind of a before and after. And Caron did well during all 26 of those years. But, a lot of people would ask me early on, did it change the way you led? And I said, probably the fundamental difference was before I led with my head. And that's not necessarily bad. After that, I was able to lead with my heart.
And
I still had my head. But I could certainly lead with my heart. I think I had a greater empathy and understanding. I mean, there were things that beforehand I couldn't do. I started telling my story. I had no story to share before 2008. Now I have an experience and that I thought was really quite beneficial. But one of the things that we all understand, any of us who are in recovery, none of us go to treatment on a winning streak. Something bad happens legally, professionally, financially, medically, with your family. And I was in, so this for me was my, was my bottom was that. And I never will forget sitting in the jail in Palm Beach County. And I don't know how I was so afraid, disgusted with myself. And as we see some of the jails, my wife was just asking me, she said, wow, they like have toilets and you got to drink out. I said, yeah. I said, that's what it was. I said, I was so frightened for the 8 hours I was in jail. I never went to the bathroom. I have no idea how. I remember them throwing a bag of bologna sandwiches in there for us to it was a big holding cell with like 30 of us or whatever. And I was sitting all by myself and this guy comes over and says, first time in here, huh? And I said, yes, it is. And he goes, I can always tell first timers. He goes, you'll get used to it. I said, no, I won't. This is one and done for me. One and done. And knock on wood, day at a time, it's been one and done.
Thank God.
What the hell did you tell everybody back at the office?
I've got a problem and I need to go get treatment. So I wanted to go to some place west of the Mississippi River. That was also an elite top flight, Caron caliber treatment center. And since I know all of them and, I knew where I wanted to go. So, I decided to go to CR Tucson. One of the reasons west of the Mississippi River, I just didn't want to bump into anybody that, had worked for Caron or had been treated at Caron and even out there, I actually did run into somebody who kind of figured out who I was because I went in as just, a healthcare professional, but, finally somebody, did kind of say, you look a lot like Doug Thiemann, who was president of Caron. Yeah, that's because I'm him. Yeah. I wasn't going to lie about it, but I didn't want to be a treatment professional in treatment because I didn't want other, I was there for me. I wasn't there to critique or comment on it. I didn't want other patients to ask me how it worked. I was there for me.
Right.
And that was my sole purpose. I knew treatment worked. I've seen it happen to thousands and thousands of people. I was excited about treatment. The thing that I didn't totally understand was the consequences of our behavior and having to deal with that. And so for the first year or so, that was the best part about having a program, having a good sponsor, having a good aftercare program because of the stuff I had to deal with, whether it was publicity, putting my family back together. I mean, after all of this and kind of coming clean with my wife and kids, what I'd been doing on some of these trips, I mean, not an easy thing to deal with. And fortunately, my wife was very willing, after learning more about all of this, very willing to do her own recovery. And we'll both say today that we hated this thing happening, but it's the best thing that ever happened to our marriage. I mean, our marriage today is so good. And remember, I was unfaithful. I violated our wedding vows. She knows all of that. And for her to say this is the best thing that ever happened to our marriage says a lot about what recovery can do.
You know, did you feel like a lot of pressure that year from Karen to perform a certain way? Was there, what shifted in your CEO position? Because in the end of the day, you're a high-powered individual, you know, who is surrounded by this 24/7. So what shifted for you?
I mean, that was actually a big question. Should I come back as CEO or not? I mean, there was a real, you know, I had to go and chat with the board. I mean, it was quite a heated and, you know, people had very different views. I mean, and none of it was out of disgust for me. As one of our board members said it so well at the very beginning, he said, you know, we're coming at this as we understand this is a disease, not a disgrace. You happen to have a disease that many of us have. The question is it fair to you, fair to Karen, fair to your family to come back on a full-time basis and run a complex, growing, dynamic organization while at the same time trying to work on your marriage and your family? Is that it, can you do that? And also, so ultimately, you know, I never forget one of the things that we talked about. I said, you know, there's a lot of myths and gossip. And, you know, I mean, there were people who thought I had been in recovery and I'd relapsed. Not true. Right. I mean, there were all kinds of things that people thought I did. And while I did a lot of bad things, there was, you know, a lot of stuff I didn't do that, you know, people might have thought. And I said, you know, if I leave, I think it's bad for Karen and for me, because it will sort of sustain, you know, there's something they're not telling us. There's something going on here. You know, they were concerned, would people continue to refer to a place that has, you know, a CEO that's in, you know, 90 days of recovery. And by the way, I didn't come back to Karen. I was about 120 days sober when I came back. So I did get a 4-month medical leave to go to treatment, do aftercare, which was a great blessing. So I did come back after about 120 days. And I said, why don't we just see how it goes? Let's do a 90-day, 180-day, 360 days. And I don't know if I can do it. I can tell you I can do it. I can think I can do it, but we don't know if I can do it until I do it. So why don't we come back and let's be perfectly candid with each other. If I find out that this job is compromising my recovery, compromising my ability to work on my marriage and my family, I will resign. And by the same token, if you find that I can't do this job, if people don't want to refer to Karen, if staff doesn't want to work for somebody in early recovery, you tell them, I'll resign. Mm-hmm. Let's do that and see what happens.
Now, you know, what I want to know.
And it worked pretty good for the next 13 years.
I suspect it was the opposite, actually. It probably enhanced your ability to do things. It probably was.
It did, but, you know, we don't know this. And, you know, again, we've all been in recovery a lot of time, and a lot of people in early recovery say all kinds of things that we believe to be true and we believe we can do. But until you do it a day at a time, you don't know if you can. And you know, people ask me about recovery for me, I'm a very black and white person. I can live in gray as an addict beautifully. Black and white, I understood. I mean, Karen made it real simple, you know, because I remember when I picked up my 15-year, coin, and someone said, is that 15 years continuous? And I said, yeah, not a relapse anywhere. And I said, no. And he said, how do you do that? And he says, real simple to me, black and white. I knew that if I drank again, I would not have the be CEO of Karen. I knew if I drank again, I wouldn't have my lovely wife and kids anymore. Very, very simple. I work real well with that. And something I tell all of my sponsees, I said, there's three keys. Number one is you got to be willing. Now, we may not get willing until the blank hits the fan.
Right.
But you got to have a willingness to do this. The second thing that you have to do is have some level of self-awareness. And most of us in our addiction have very little self-awareness. But in early recovery, you begin to get it. And so I said, you got to be self-aware about how you feel, what you're doing, as well as your impact on others. And the third is, you know, something I call accountability. And you can't have accountability unless you have a plan and you're honest with someone. Initially, it's probably your sponsor because you're we're incapable of doing that ourselves. But I need you to be honest with me. If you drink, you use, you do whatever, tell me. Eventually, I want you to tell me before you use, but tell me right afterwards, and we'll talk about it, and we'll develop another plan. But those are the three things that I learned early on that were real important to me. I was super willing. I was willing before I even got sober because I didn't like living like that.
Tell us about what you're doing today. Now, in the post-Karen era, you were with Karen for almost 3 decades.
Yes.
And I know you're doing some interesting things right now. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I'm on 3 nonprofit boards. One is a health system board, which is like 4 or 5 hospitals. I'm also on a university board. However, I'm stepping down from that at the end of this month. I'm on another nonprofit board. It's called STAR Network, which is survivors of trauma and abusive relationships. So much of addiction comes from untreated trauma that this, nonprofit really kind of, got me. So again, if you had trauma in your life, everything is free at the STAR Network. Just go to the STAR, STAR, Network Foundation. And there's, Taranon meetings. We called it Toxic Abusive Relationships Anonymous, built on the same concept as, the big book.
But if you can go back and tell your younger self, and this younger self could be someone in 2001, or it could be your 10-year-old, 9-year-old mm-hmm. self, or whenever trauma hit for you, what would you go back and say, and what age would you be?
The single biggest thing for me would have been to have not sacrificed my family for my career. I was so driven to be successful that I made my wife and kids, second and third place. And for that, we're not supposed to have any regrets, but for that, that's the best part of recovery. It gave me a second chance at doing that. So taking care of yourself, whatever that might be, staying healthy, staying religious, staying, eating right, whatever that definition is for you is when you begin to compromise that, you need to really look in the mirror. And unfortunately, a lot of us have difficulty, doing that. So we need that outside influence, whatever it is. As I said, no one gets in recovery because we're on a winning streak.
Douglas, thank you so much. I am honored that you came here from Pennsylvania, drove all the way up to New York City to be with Irene and with me. And we're grateful for your sharing your life and your story with our audience. You're an amazing guy, and you're just getting started. And we'll keep doing it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for doing what you're doing. You help a lot of people.
It's a privilege to do it. It's a privilege to do it. And to you folks who are listening to us, we're grateful for your likes and for your support. Smack that bell. Tell us that you like what we're doing. Give us your comments. Follow us. And we are grateful for your keeping Crosstalk Podcasts alive. The Crosstalk Official Foundation is working hard to keep doing this. Thank you so much for watching. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.